Hey everybody, this is Andy, aka Love Retro BTW, across Twitter, Instagram, and Twitch. I do a podcast every Saturday called Cafe BTW, a morning gaming podcast, a retrospective look at the wonderful world of retro gaming, from interviews to guests. Join us every Saturday, like a Saturday morning cartoon, starting at 8 a.m., 11 a.m. Eastern. Also, if you're on Twitter, please join the brand new retro gaming community, a place to share, connect, and show your love for the retro gaming community. All the links are down below. And remember, enjoy the Gamers Week podcast.
This time on Gamers Week podcast.
Unless if they come out with like another attachment or kind of like the foot attachment that you use to lay the PS5 on its side, maybe they'll put one of this type on it.
Maybe. We'll just start stacking them like you do with the Genesis and all these various things.
I was about
to
say that. It's like, what are we in the, like the Genesis 32X Sega CD era? Are we just doing plug-in consoles in that sense now? We're going backwards.
PS5 Tower of Power, when?
Right.
Blue is our resident master of Lion King.
Really?
Yeah.
I had it when I was a kid, and we didn't have a ton of games when I was a kid. So I played the hell out of Lion King and got to the point where I could beat it like with my eyes closed.
Nice. I am still terrible at it.
Well, I did a playthrough a couple of years ago for a charity stream and realized I don't remember quite as much as I thought I did. So I did beat it on stream, but I made everybody who was watching swear not to tell that I used the rewind feature to do it. All right. Are you guys ready to get this started?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome to Gamers Week Podcast. Like the name says, we analyze the best, worst, and weirdest headlines of the past week in the video game industry. This is episode 40, and today is Wednesday, September 21st, 2022. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. My name is Blue Williams, and I'll be your host for this evening. As you can hear, my voice is still pretty wrecked, so I appreciate everybody staying patient with me, and if it helps you, you can just imagine that Scarlett Johansson is hosting the show today. But I'm not alone. As you can hear, I have two fine gentlemen accompanying me tonight. My first co-host is a man who can currently tell us whether or not the snozzberries taste like snozzberries. Please, everyone, say hello to Ryan Payne, aka Retro Game Brews.
How's it going, everyone? So happy to be here. And Blue, congratulations on that winning the contest over the weekend for a froggy from the Little Rascals impersonator. So congratulations.
I was waiting for you to finish this joke. I was like, where is he going with this? And as you have probably noticed, we are absent the one and only Donnie G. He disappeared into a mosh pit about 3 days ago, and we haven't seen him since. So we're not really sure where he is, but we assume he's fine. But instead, we are joined by G to the next level. He is a retro gamer you can find on YouTube and Twitch. He is a member of Team Sega and a Capcom creator. G, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Of course. So do you mind introducing yourself a little bit to the listeners and letting people know where can they find your stuff?
Sure. Well, I'm G to the next level, you know, like welcome to the next level, but with a G like me. Blue mentioned, I basically do retro gaming and retro inspired gaming on both YouTube and Twitch, mainly centered around Sega, but not exclusive to it. Also do like PlayStation, Neo Geo, TurboGrafx, the Nintendo, the whole nine, like anything about retro, but it always pretty much comes back to Sega for me. That's my main. I love it. I love Sonic the Hedgehog. Those are like my main things to go to. And yeah, you can find me pretty much anywhere where you could search for G to the next level. YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, pretty much anywhere there you can find me.
Nice. And we will definitely have links to all of G's stuff in the show notes. So when you're done listening here, be sure to head on over to his links and check him out. But for now, let's go ahead and get the show started with our reviews, reactions, and requests. Colonel Falcon says, I listened to episode 38. It is great. And thanks for the mention. Very much appreciated. The guy who was selling his epic collection on eBay also had like almost all different bundles and packs that can easily get you to that number of 1 million. And yes, Pong clones too. Episode 39 also rocks. Tsar Leo said, to add to the PS1 talk, I think the console being so limited in what it could do made it better. I theorize games like Silent Hill wouldn't have been the greatness it was if they had a need to work around what the PS1 could and couldn't do. Maybe I'm wrong, though. No, Leo, I don't think you are wrong. I 100% agree.
I think the fog feature definitely added to the game. So,
mm-hmm. I mean, it was really impressive what Konami could do with the PS1 when dealing with Silent Hill. It's like going back and looking at it, it might be a little bit murky, but if you really think about it for the time, it was quite impressive. They were able to manipulate that.
Definitely. And finally, Arcade Main says, yeah, Gargoyles as a standalone remaster is an odd choice. It would be fine in a collection with others, but it's not a great game. And I feel significant work would have to be done to make it something you play for more than 10 minutes for that nostalgia hit and then never touch again.
I think when it comes to Gargoyles, of course, that's a Genesis game. So I was just like, ooh, my ears are burning. But I kind of agree with Arcade Main. It's okay. It's good, but it's not great. It's really tough. I mean, like, I wouldn't really say it's quite Lion King hard, but I mean, Blue, you would know about that. But it's, I think it's cool that it's seeing it, but I guess we'll just have to wait and see like what kind of if they're going to do any enhancements like they did with Aladdin and the Lion King, and I guess how much it's going to be, because as standalone, that's really important. If it's too pricey, then they might price themselves out.
Yeah. No, what I think I would love to see if it was offered as like a DLC to the Aladdin Lion King package they already have.
That's a great idea.
Seriously consider getting it. But as a standalone, yeah, probably not if I'm paying like Disney prices for it. Probably not.
No.
And now it's time for the
very important poll.
I decided to do Kermit because all of my stuff is in green. And as Kermit says,
it's not easy being green.
I mean, I think you've done Kermit before.
Have I?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe you have, but that's none of my business, though.
Well done.
I see what you did there.
Well, every Monday on Twitter, we post our VIP or very important poll. If you'd like to participate, follow us on Twitter at GamersWeekPC. This question for the week was, what is your favorite Sega Genesis original soundtrack? Ooh. So coming in third was Thunder Force 3 at 8.8%. Second was Shining Force 2 at 12.7%. And crushing this week's poll was Streets of Rage 2 with 58.4%.
Well deserved.
Indeed. And 20.1% of you said other. So let's look at some of the comments from the poll. At SandyLander77 said, Revenge of Shinobi is excellent. Alice and the Vixen said, torn between Gunstar and Glay Lancer.
Ooh, that's a deep cut.
Right? Adrian O'Neill said, The Terminator. Love that game. Six Ninja Fist said, Streets of Rage 1 just hits me the right way every single time. And Falksy 22 said, The results tell me that not enough people have played Thunder Force 3.
Touché. Yeah, fair. But I also wonder if any of them have played Thunder Force 4, aka Lightning Force. Because the soundtrack on that, I mean, Thunder Force 3 is a great soundtrack. But 4, if you've never heard 4's soundtrack, it's incredible. Just the bass on it, it's absolutely amazing.
Completely agree. In fact, I was jockeying back and forth between 3 and 4, but one of the things that we've been doing with polls lately is to avoid any of our bias coming into play. Is I've been looking up IGN top 10.
Very fair.
So we use somebody else's bias.
Exactly. So
that makes it fine.
Lay the blame on someone else.
Well, then I see your Thunder Force 4, and can I toss you a Gauntlet 4?
Ooh, okay. Well, we will definitely get to that. But Blue, what did you pick based off of the answers here?
So I went into this a little handicapped because I didn't grow up with a Sega Genesis. In fact, I only got a Genesis a few years ago, so I'm woefully behind on Genesis games. But the one that immediately came to mind for me was Toe Jam and Earl.
Ooh, okay.
Oh, excellent.
That is an excellent soundtrack. And when I was a kid, my cousin left his Genesis at our house for a few months, and that was the game he left us, was Toe Jam and Earl. So we played the absolute hell out of that game. And not only do I think the music is excellent, but it also, every time I play it on YouTube, I get this massive nostalgia hit from it. So nice. I love it. It is definitely my favorite.
And it's such an odd game, which makes it so much more fun. And then the music, of course, adds to the background of that. So
right, absolutely. It was like nothing I'd ever played before. We were Nintendo kids. We had an NES and a Super Nintendo. So when we saw that game, it was completely different. It added to like the exotic mystery of the Genesis that we never got to really experience. But it was very cool.
Yep, one of the many offbeats that over time people have not just started more and more started realizing. I mean, it helped that Toe Jam and Earl just got a remake recently, or a new game, sorry, just got a new game recently. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It is one of those games that, and me growing up with the Genesis, that when my friends had Nintendo, because I was one of the few that had Sega, when we talk about stuff like Toe Jam and Earl, it's not anything like anything they had on the Super Nintendo. So it would be right. Like, oh, that's cool. And it's funky. And that's probably the best way to say it, really.
Right. Yes, it felt very funky in the 90s. And now when you go back and you're like, you just can't help but smile. Mm-hmm.
So, G, what is your favorite Sega Genesis OST?
I mean, the poll took it from me. It's Streets of Rage 2, hands down. No, but the thing is, I know that's the easy answer. It's like Streets of Rage 2 is the easy answer, but I could probably give you one of my, if I could top like a really, really good deep cut that I love dearly as far as soundtracks go. If you ever heard of a tank game called Granada? So there's a top-down action tank game called Granada. It's done by Wolf Team and Renovation here in the U.S. It's coming to the Genesis Mini, too, which is awesome. If you listen to the soundtrack, it's done by Motoi Sakuraba. A wonderful soundtrack. Incredible soundtrack. And most of the games that they've done have been awesome. El Viento, Arcus Odyssey, plenty of other games that they did. But that soundtrack just, it really, as you said, Ryan, it just hits you right in the heart. And it was unexpected the first time I ever played that game. That soundtrack's incredible. Check it out.
I'm going to have to now.
Yeah, definitely will. So what about you, Ryan? What did you vote?
So I also would say Streets of Rage 2 is definitely one of those games that just the soundtrack, just even from the beginning, right? With the title screen that comes up, it just, bam, puts you right in the right mood to play the game. But if I had to choose one that wasn't in the poll, I would go with Contra Hardcore. I think that really encompasses the action element to the game. It's very like metal almost in a way. And it hits right as soon as you start the game. So you're crashing into the first board in like a van or something. And then you pop out and the music is blaring right in your face. And it just pumps the adrenaline right from the get-go. And it never stops. That game continues to pump your heart and get everything going. So Contra Hardcore is definitely one of those games that I listen to the soundtrack even when I'm not playing.
Very nice. All right, let's move on to our patron shout-outs. We couldn't do what we do without the help of our gorgeous patrons. Here are the generous folks supporting Gamers Week on Patreon. Rye Bread's number one fan, Fruitcake's number one stan, Ducks with Thick Thighs, The Wizard of Zardoz, Clayman71, Great Salmon81, BNT Zilligai, Geek With That, Crunchy Kong, Sheriff Snacks, Frank Grande, JNL Game, Love Retro BTW, Steven Sand, Ramboski, Terry Kinnair, Ducks in Disguise, Jim and Colleen, Games with Coffee, Davey PGH, the Redox PDX family, including Shannon and Luke, Zach Huge Thanks, Random Retro Dude, Princess Kitty Mew Mew, Rai Rai's Secret Breast Friend, Mega Retro Man, Gamatroid, Emo-esque, and Bill Tucker. If you like what you hear today, and we really hope you do, please consider joining us on Patreon. Your support helps cover the cost of producing the show, as well as other cool stuff we'll be doing, like prizes and giveaways. You'll also gain access to our weekly patron-only bonus cast called Gamers Week Uncut, Patrons with Benefits. Visit patreon.com/gamersweek or follow the link in the show notes to learn more.
All right, our headline segment is proudly sponsored by the Retro Game Club podcast. It's a fantastic family-friendly retro gaming podcast. In each episode, Rob and Hugh pick two games to play and discuss, as well as news, interviews, and other topics. Currently, they're playing through Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and TMNT Tournament Fighters. Visit them at retrogameclub.net or follow the link in the show notes. Have either of you guys played the NES version of Tournament Fighters?
Yes. Actually, I just spent an entire week on Twitch streaming all the games in the Cowabunga collection.
Oh,
and
wow.
Nice. That game just... So I'd only played a little tiny bit of Tournament Fighters like through various means like back in the day, right? I could never actually get a copy of that game. It's really, really rare and hard to find.
Right.
But playing it on the Cowabunga collection for the first time just realizes how well made. Like, Konami did such a wonderful job doing the best that they possibly could squeeze out of the NES. Like, the animation is excellent. The music is excellent. The controls, honestly, out of the three Tournament Fighters games, I found that doing the special moves and the controls in this one just felt the most responsive. It was odd. Even though, yeah, it doesn't have that many characters, it doesn't have that many stages, but it's shockingly good. I really enjoyed it.
The one thing I did find playing it, though, is that you can kind of cheese the game. So one of the moves is obviously you can knock into somebody and then throw them.
Yep.
You can chain those back and forth for everybody but Shredder, pretty much. So getting to Shredder, not so hard. Beating Shredder, different story.
But right.
You know, at the end of the day, it's still super fun. If I remember right, too, it's got a versus mode. So if you got two players, you can play that as well. So,
yep.
Super.
I also
super
love
fun.
How, like, on the Cowabunga collection, they found the because there was a code to get a workaround for you to have a hothead mirror match. You could have hothead versus hothead. Because before, you could only have one player be hothead. But now in the Cowabunga collection, it's easily selectable without a code. So, you know, two players could play hothead against each other and watch the poor NES go burr as it tries to have both of them on the screen at the same time.
Awesome.
Okay, so from The Ringer, the Grand Theft Auto leak is enormous news that may not matter. So late on Saturday night, something incredible happened. A rumor from Grand Theft Auto 6 actually turned out to be true. The leak came from a thread at the website GTA Forums, where a user named Teapot Uber Hacker, who claimed to be the same person who hacked Uber last week, matter of factly stated, here are 90 footage slash clips from GTA 6. And there they were. Image and nearly an hour's worth of clips out of a nowhere near half-baked build of the game, including videos of a female playable protagonist accompanied by a male sidekick, orchestrating a hostage situation inside and outside of a diner, a male playable protagonist strolling around a strip club and talking to NPCs at a pool, and several sequences of outdoor driving or walking. Given the scope of the leak, this unsanctioned sneak peek was huge news, yet it was also underwhelming. GTA 6, or whatever it will one day be dubbed, looked, well, like an early version of a video game, which is to say, understandably unfinished. On the whole, the market mostly seems to have shrugged, although Take-Two's stock price sank early in the day, it bounced back by the afternoon. Other industry analysis sounded much more bullish, with the Wedbush Securities' Michael Pachter stated that the leak was interestingly public publicity and nothing eventful, and that nothing meaningful will come from it. Other games that suffered memorable leaks or hacks included Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3 and Call of Duty Advanced Warfare, Far Cry 2, Mass Effect 3, Fallout 4, StarCraft 2, Halo 2, and The Witcher 3. Most of those games had something else in common. They were critical and commercial successes that are remembered less for their leaks than for being stone-cold classics.
So, I'm going to say leaks have become a big business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's. I think we've now kind of gotten to the point to where it's a thing, and it's just, you see it for a second, it's like, oh, okay, that's neat. All right, and then just kind of go back to your day, right?
And yet it's weird because you have people like this Teapot Uber Hacker, who, by the way, is being investigated by the FBI right now.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
I think that's not more surprised to do with them hacking Uber than hacking Take-Two. But I don't really understand the motive behind it, I guess, because if you're going to go and hack all this stuff and then just drop it, like for the clout's sake of just dropping this leak.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
It's to be firsties, basically. It's like, hey, I was the first one to grab this, and they're willing to put an infamy on the line. in order to do it. So, I mean, I guess, you know, more power to you. But the problem is that, you know, like great power comes great responsibility. And you chose dark. So, yeah, they're probably right. going to get what's coming to them.
Right. Of course, after that happens, along with the clout chasers comes games media. And I will fully admit that I have been involved in many websites in games media. I've worked for many of those websites. And the push to be on these leaks immediately, the push to sensationalize them as much as possible, to play it up as much as possible so that you can get the views and the clicks while it's hot.
Right.
It's a machine that sustains itself through actions that I don't think are positive for anybody except for those sites involved and the individual hacker. So I would be more than thrilled to see the rest of the world begin to shrug their shoulders at leaks and for this to become a thing that's not worth doing anymore.
Right, right.
But the interesting part about that is that it does, in a way, yes, games companies don't want their stuff leaked because it can potentially ruin some of the fun and, you know, run into a situation where maybe parts of the game that you don't intend to make public are now out there. So you've got to change some of the ways in which you program for it. But honestly, I mean, I think they pointed out at the end of that article that a lot of the games that experience leaks like this end up creating more hype for the game. So
yeah,
it's like, yes, this is a bad thing, but at the end of the day, it's also a positive for these games companies. So, I mean, you would imagine that a company like Take-Two would have amazing security set up to prevent this kind of stuff. So, in a way, it's their fault.
Because, oh, absolutely. Oh,
right? Blame the victim. Damn.
Well, I mean, cybersecurity is a real thing, right? It's like for a multi-billion-dollar company like Take-Two, you would think that they would have top-tier security in place for something like that.
Exactly. Right? So if you really don't want leaks, invest in the security, right?
Yeah. And for something like Grand Theft Auto, I think probably one of the other reasons why maybe they thought that they were going to get a bigger negative impact or however by leaking it, is just that Grand Theft Auto is such a gigantic franchise that to them is like, if they think that this was going to be okay, well, you know what, I'm going to try to give you a nice, you know, punch in the face. This is what I think about you, Grand Theft Auto. I'm going to leak your stuff. And all they literally did was like graze the tip of their nose. Like literally that's it. Like,
right.
Okay, whatever. People are still going to be excited for this. It's still going to sell millions of copies. So what's the point? Aside from, as you said, blue clout, that's literally the only reason.
Right.
At least in what I can think of.
Yeah, that's a hacker's MO, right?
Right.
A lot of the hackers aren't looking out there.
Unethical hackers.
Right. indeed. But they're not looking to make money off this stuff. They really want to be famous for, anonymously famous, but famous.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's resulted of this has been a big show of support on Twitter for the developers, for the Take-Two devs, from other developers who have experienced leaks and have been commiserating with them about how disappointing it is to have your stuff shown before you were ready to show it.
Right.
Because there are those people out there. They will see like the alpha builds or whatever and go, oh, it looks horrible. You know, this game is going to suck. And while that may not ultimately matter once the game is actually finished and released, right now it is probably subjecting the devs to some abuse that they don't deserve.
For sure.
Next up from IGN, Sega explains what Sonic Frontiers open zone structure actually means. Sonic Frontiers will be the first new 3D Sonic title since 2017's Sonic Forces. Unlike previous level-based endeavors, however, Sonic Frontiers will be the series' first title to boast a vast and freely explorable world, which Sega refers to as open zone. So why is it an open zone as opposed to an open world? Director Morio Kishimoto refers to open zone as Sonic Frontiers' secret weapon. Level-based platformers often have a world map. Our open zone is a world map, only we've made it entirely playable, Kishimoto stated. A playable world map that includes stage-like elements is something that hasn't really been done before, so we had to come up with a new name. What is often defined as a world in other level-based platformers is called a zone in Sonic games, so we took that and combined it with open, which refers to a freely explorable field. So that's what open zone stands for. Kishimoto sees the open zone as an evolution of the traditional world map, of course, one that has been tailored to match Sonic's high-speed gameplay. The open zone also gives room for more diverse gameplay. Sonic Frontiers comes with a more fleshed-out combat system, as well as puzzles scattered throughout the open zone. The latter will offer some quieter moments, a rarity in Sonic games. Kishimoto says that while it should take the average player between 20 and 30 hours to finish the game, while completionists can easily spend double the time to see everything. So, gee, I'm sure you have big opinions on this, but I'll just get in real fast and say this has been needlessly confusing.
You know what? Let me make it simple for you, because I've read it a couple of times over, and now I think I kind of get the idea of it. Have you played Sonic Generations before?
No.
Okay. So in Sonic Generations, there is an overworld in that game where it's comprised of classic stages from various Sonic games. That there's a 2D stage and a 3D stage in each. But there is an overworld that actually goes in between each that's interactive to where you can jump from side to side and go from world to world. So imagine that, but actually in an open environment. So it's essentially like it's a little bit marketing speak. It is a little bit marketing speak, because it's like, okay, Green Hill Zone, Chemical Plant Zone, like Sonic is known for zones, right? So instead of an open world, it's an open zone. So it's a little tiny bit of marketing speak. But mm-hmm. at the same time, it's like, okay, we're giving you this overmap, but there's going to be little tiny things that you could do in the each open map. It's like, as far as they say, that these are things that haven't really been done in other games before. They kind of have, like, in that mm-hmm. sense. But now I'm thinking that they're doing it to where you'll have something like Breath of the Wild, where you'll have this open area. You can go from zone to zone,
right?
But in a much more faster pace with a lot more Sonic style puzzles to do in between. That's kind of the gist that I get with it. I don't know. I feel like that was a little bit fluffy when you could have just said, okay, it's an open world environment that feels like Sonic.
Exactly.
That's exactly what it is.
that's been the part that's been needlessly confusing, is since we got those gameplay drops earlier in the summer. And we got that first gameplay drop where Sonic runs around and fights some low level enemies and solves some really easy puzzles in an environment that the whole world said, gosh, that looks exactly like Breath of the Wild. This is Breath of the Wild Sonic, Blur of the Wild, as Ducks in Disguise coined it when he was on our show. And then they're going, no, it's not. And this whole time they presented Sonic running around in their, world map, so to speak, as if that was the actual gameplay. And they've kind of let people believe that that is the gameplay. But so this means it's not. It's just the world map. And I guess you run around the world map looking for the levels that lead to the actual gameplay. Or is the world map the gameplay? They could not have made this less audience friendly if they actively tried.
I know. It's like, I love Sega. That it seems like they're trying way too hard. It's like, hey, we're just giving you this open free world for you to explore around. And then as you're exploring those levels, you will find puzzles. You'll see familiar characters. More of the story will unfold. You'll have these nice quiet moments, but you'll also have those hype moments that you're known to expect from the Sonic franchise with fast pounding gameplay, easy controls. From what I gather, like, it looks like it's really easy. And it says right there, I'm seeing that sentence one more time, and it says, our open zone is a world map, only we've made it entirely playable. Should take the average player between 20 to 30 hours to finish the game, while completionists can easily spend double the time to see everything. It kind of sounds an awful lot like Breath of the Wild.
Thank you.
It kind of does. And to me, it's like, you know what? They're really trying their hardest to avoid saying that, but I don't really think it would be a bad thing to just say, hey, it's an open world Sonic. Trust us, you're going to love this.
Right.
And just be simple with that. And I understand the Sonic fan base is very judgmental. I understand that it takes a lot to impress them, especially when you're presenting something that's pretty much brand new. It's scary. I get it. New Sonic is scary. I get it. But I'm actually still really excited about it. Even with all this jargon and whatnot, from what I see in the gameplay footage, and from what I've heard from, like, after Tokyo Game Show and whatnot, the impressions were good.
I was actually going to ask you, does this make you more excited, less excited, or indifferent? It sounds like it makes you... maybe indifferent? Is that where I'm getting?
It didn't really get me. Reading this didn't really get me any more hype for it. It's like, I kind of already expected this. You just explained this in like three paragraphs, where you could have just said it in one sentence.
Pretty much.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'm going to say this makes me more annoyed for the game. This makes me less want to play the game, because
fair.
Like I already said, I guess there's a reason why they make games and they're not marketers, because you're doing this all wrong, Sega. You're presenting this game all wrong. And I just hope that it succeeds in spite of how you have presented it to your audience for the first time.
Right. It's like, give us simplicity of what to expect from your game. This is what's coming. This is how it looks. Get hot and get excited. No more charts, please. just like explain like what's coming with the game. If you are going to do DLC, great. Explain it in a very simple fashion and just be done with it. Simplicity is good. I like simple.
You didn't like the chart?
Oh, no. Have y'all not seen the charts?
Oh, we've seen the chart.
Oh, we've seen them, yes.
Oh, Sonic Origins. But anyway.
Anyway.
All right, next up from The Verge, Sony's first major PS5 redesign will reportedly have a detachable disk drive. The next revision of the PS5 could include a removable disk drive, potentially letting you play games using a drive connected via USB-C. According to Insider Gaming, the report says that we could see this new model of PS5 around September of 2023. The PS5 currently comes in two versions, one with disk drive built in and a digital-only edition that can't read discs, even if you plug a USB drive into it. It sounds like Sony's trying to do away with the digital/disc divide, instead selling the same console with or without the drive bundled in. Hopefully, this means that you'll be able to upgrade the console with a disk drive later on, even if you opted to save some money when you first bought the PS5. At this point, it's hard to say exactly how the addition of an external drive will change the PS5's polarizing aesthetics. In theory, the new revision could just end up looking like the current PS5 digital edition, except with an extra USB-C port on the back. According to Insider Gaming, the revision will completely replace the chassis that are on sale today, but will have almost identical hardware. It sounds like it'll be a bit of a wait before the option becomes available, but that's understandable given the Sony's also working on another major hardware launch right now, the PSVR 2, a next-gen virtual reality headset meant to pair with the PS5.
I love this idea. Mm-hmm. As everyone knows, the PS5's in either iteration, the full version or the digital only, they're hard to come by. And for like the first year and a half after it released and I was searching desperately for one, sometimes I would come across an opportunity to get the digital only. And that's not what I wanted. I want to be able to play discs, but what if I never get an opportunity to get another one? And I'm kind of feeling like that right now also with looking at getting an Xbox Series. I would like an X, but the S is more available. Mm-hmm. If this was an option to just add a disk drive later if you chose to, that would completely relieve this tension of which one do I choose?
Right. My thing is, I think it's a good idea. As long as it's going to do something to improve the availability of the PS5, mm-hmm. I'm down for it. If it's not going to make things any better, in my opinion, this might sound harsh, but I'm like, don't even bother. You need to get the systems out to people. It's like, it's neat. It's neat to give people options. Options are good. Just you kind of think about it this way, too. So say, for example, they're coming out with this and then it does make the PS5s more available. Now you have those options. So are they going to make the drives available as like a separate purchase for you to readily buy in a store or something like that? Or is that you buy it in this form and then you get the disk drives of like direct to order from Sony or something like that? Because I worry that they might go this option. And what if people opt out of buying the digital drives? And all the digital drives are just roughly everywhere. Or maybe it's the other way around. Now, those digital drives are hard to get. Because not too many people are buying them. They're not making enough of them. And so I don't know. I'm just wondering what's really the supply and the demand on that. I'm sure they probably have that figured out. But to me, it's like it seems like a neat idea. And again, I like having those options. But yeah, if it's going to bring the cost down, one, and make the PS5s more available, too, then yeah, I'm 100% for it.
And the concerns that I would have, for one, is just from a size factor. The PS5 is an enormous machine.
She's a big girl.
I totally didn't even cover that. Oh, yeah, because I have a PS5. It's gigantic.
And you're going to add another piece of hardware next to it. So unless you have a pretty decent sized entertainment console, that might not fit. And it might be something where you're going to have to like hang it off the wall in order for it to work or stack things on top of each other. So
right. Unless if they come out with like another attachment or kind of like the foot attachment that you use to lay the PS5 on its side, maybe they'll put one of the disc drive on it.
Maybe. We'll just start stacking them like you do with the Genesis and all these various things.
I was about
things.
To say that. It's like, what are we in the, like the Genesis 32X Sega CD era? Are we just doing plug-in consoles in that sense now? We're going backwards.
PS5 Tower of Power, when?
Right.
The other piece to it, though, is if they are going to make it available for, say, if you bought a digital-only version, and they're going to make it available for folks to purchase separately, I would imagine the cost of that disk drive is going to be pretty expensive. My guess is north of $100. So you tried to save money by purchasing a digital-only version versus a disk drive version, and now in order for you to get that disk drive, you're going to have to spend $100 extra or more, potentially. So in a way, it kind of goes against that whole thought process of I was going to save money by doing digital only if I plan to purchase it. Now, granted, it's not required, so that's up to you. But again, it's just more money that's coming out of your pocket in order to play games.
Right.
And I think G makes a good point about could they phase out the drive on the side if they're not selling as well? Mm-hmm. And that actually leads me to think about how we've been talking the last several episodes about the inevitability of the digital only age.
Right. Yep. Because that might provide the analytics that they need. It's like, hey, the people don't want this. And then guess what? They come out with a PS6 and it's only digital.
Ooh.
And then Xbox comes up, and then Xbox is only digital. It could happen. I mean, the Steam Deck is only digital. Nintendo's never going to do that. I feel that. But for everybody else, though, it's a slippery slope. So we'll see.
It would provide them a real easy fast track to just phase out the disc part of things without having to change their manufacturing process.
And if you think about that, too, wasn't Sony the first one to come up with a form console that only worked with digital media in the PSP Go? Or wasn't there like another system that had that before that? Because I think it was really the first one to do that, right?
I think you are right. Yep.
Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if maybe that's the path that Sony is trying to take. So we'll see.
Now I don't love it as much as I did at first.
Right. It could happen. Now, I'm not saying it will, but I mean, it's you're right. It's a possibility.
Let's add in a da 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 da.
All right. From IGN, La Mulana director wins Konami contest to revive old IP. The search has ended. After a year-long process, Konami announced the grand prize winner of an open call for indie developers to revive older series from the company's backlog. At Tokyo Game Show, we learned the first place will go to Takumi Naramura, director of La Mulana and La Mulana 2, as he plans to remake Konami's The Maze of Gallius. Originally released as a sequel to Nightmare for an MSX computer platform in Japan in 1987, the side-scrolling platform RPG featured two heroes trying to fight their way out of a castle filled with monsters. The Maze of Gallius could be described in modern terms as a Metroidvania, since the player explores a series of interconnected rooms, gains experience points for defeating enemies, and searches for power-ups and keys. In a press release announcing the winners, representatives from the panel of contest judges wrote that they could feel tremendous passion for The Maze of Gallius, end quote, in Naramura's initial proposal, as he outlined the original game's strengths and the challenges involved in bringing it to modern audiences. The release also had a comment from Naramura, wherein he stated that if he hadn't won the contest, I'd probably just stay quiet and make the game anyway. While Naramura's entry won the top spot, four more developers were also awarded prizes for ideas. The runners-up included new versions of Star Soldier, Parodius, Twin B, and Puyon. Elsewhere, we learned that Konami's RPGs Suikoden 1 and 2 are returning with new HD remasters.
So Konami said the magic word for Blue, and that is Metroidvania.
That's it. I'm in.
It's one of their things that they do, right? And if that's an early case of it, then that's pretty neat. However, I'm like, yeah, but Parodius could have got one. Okay. But you know, that's all right. That's all right, though. I'm hyped for that. That's pretty cool.
I think you called it, Blue, when you said that you thought Twin B might be one of the games that they come out with. So
I knew it the whole time. Not a joke when I said it earlier. I knew it the whole time.
Twin B is weird. It's one of those ones that like Konami kind of keeps like in the distance that mm-hmm. they'll bring out every now and then when they just want like a really cheap pop. Like every now and then it's just like, oh, by the way, here's Twin B. Kind of like how it randomly showed up on Switch Online. I was like, wait, what? Right.
Yeah.
It's an important franchise. They don't always have it in the forefront, but it's always kind of there, like chilling in the background, kind of like Suikoden. And well, we're getting that. So,
oh, yeah. And Donnie called that one, actually. He guessed that.
That blew my mind when I saw that. I was like, what?
Right. And I think it'd be really cool. Just hearing that it's Metroidvania makes me say that I'm up to play the Maze of Gallius remake when he's done with it. But I think it'd also be really cool if they included the original game along with the remake.
Yeah, sure. They really should. And honestly, I think in most cases with remakes, whenever you do a remake of a game, it's just always just a nice touch to add the original in there.
which most of the time publishers do not do, and they do right. not care. But yeah, I think that would be great.
I'm all sold for Suikoden in 1 and 2. I loved 2. I owned it. I traded it in, so I want it back.
So you didn't love it that much.
I didn't trade it and I take it back. I traded it with another person to get a few other games. So it was hard to see it go, but the fact that they're making a HD remaster for it has me super excited. So I'm right. all in for that.
I like that it's specifically a remaster.
Right, exactly. Because the game is fantastic. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it needs the remake polish that or, you know, changes.
Let's just Final Fantasy VII it. Come on now.
Oh, God, stop.
Imagine this, though, like if they did a remake of that in the fashion of style like Live Alive. Like something like that would have been wonderful.
Sign me up.
Or Octopath Traveler. I guess that's the other one I was really thinking about.
But yeah. I do love the HD 2D thing mm-hmm. that they seems to be really hot right now. But sure. if you guys could remake something from Konami's history, what would be your choice?
Oh,
too besides many. The Adventures of Bayou Billy?
Too many options. Oh, wait. No, it already got a remake and it didn't do so well.
Is that right? I didn't even know.
No, not Bayou Billy. Like what I was going to say, what my choice was. I was like, wait a minute. No, it did get it. Well, technically it was a new game. It was a reboot. It wasn't a remake. I was thinking Rocket Knight Adventures.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It got a reboot and it wasn't great. But what's another one that I guess I could probably say? If they had the rights to it, Bucky O'Hare, I guess.
Oh, fantastic choice. That game excellent is awesome. Call. It's hard. Oh my God, is it so hard?
I love that game.
It's like if you wanted Mega Man to be harder than it already is, play Bucky O'Hare.
See, that's debatable. That's debatable to me because like I've beaten Bucky O'Hare recently and I'm like, is this really harder than a Mega Man game?
Oh, he just threw a get good scrub at you.
I don't know. I mean, the last couple, especially when you get to the cells, yeah, it starts getting really tough. But they're either on par or I feel like some of the Mega Man games might slightly be tougher. But I don't know. That's just me, though.
And it may be just because I grew up so much playing Mega Man games that it becomes like second nature to me based off of just the gameplay is almost always so similar. But Mega Man, it like speaks to me. I don't know why. I'm not good at games, but I can master a Mega Man game. I don't know what it is.
And you just get in the zone, you feel it.
That's right.
All right, let's move on to our top three new releases of the week. First up is Serial Cleaners, out on the PS5, Xbox Series X and S, PS4, Xbox One, Switch, and PC. Serial Cleaners is a top-down stealth action game where you get to experience being a murder scene cleaner for the mob in 1990s New York. I didn't know there was people asking for that.
Yeah, it seems like a kind of a strange premise, so to speak on. But, you know, it's different.
Alternate between four cleaners, each with their own unique style, and live their stories. A good cleaner never gets caught, so you have to make sure you get in, clean up, and get out without leaving a trace of evidence in this stylish award-winning 2D action stealth game. Next up is the Diofield Chronicle, out on PS5, Xbox Series X and S, PS4, Xbox One, Switch, and PC. An all-new strategy RPG that chronicles an epic tale of war and honor, featuring a unique and beautiful world that blends fantasy, medieval, and modern-day influences, and a deep yet innovative real-time battle system. And finally, Taiko no Tatsujin Rhythm Festival, out on the Switch. Welcome to Omiko City, the stage for Taiko no Tatsujin Rhythm Festival. A city full of everyone's favorite taiko elements is gathered into one town. 76 songs are available in the game, as well as improvement support that helps you with upping your drumming skills. Participate in online ranked matches and battle against players from around the world. So based on these three, which would you choose, G?
Well, at first I would probably want to pick Taiko Drum Master or Taiko no Tatsujin, just purely because I'm a fan of the franchise. I've loved it since the PS2 days, and it's a great franchise. But if there's one way to get close to my heart, almost especially considering like how much I love Shining Force and Disgaea and games like that, there's one way to really get close to my heart. It's a good tactical strategy game. And I saw a little bit of the Diofield Chronicles during all the games at Square, and now it's like around the Nintendo Direct and everything. And so I saw this and I was like, this looks kind of sick. Like, I kind of want to try this. And I know there's a demo out now and I really want to try it. But probably between the three. I had never heard of cereal cleaners before we started getting ready for this podcast, and I looked at it and I saw it was like kind of a little bit of cross between Disco Elysium and maybe a little bit of Hotline Miami, only it's the other way around. Like, you're, instead of you being the murderer, you're doing the cleaner, right? Right. So maybe it's that in reverse, I guess. So it's intriguing. It looks like it might be unique, but nah, I think if I had to pick between one of these three to play first, because it's like Taiko, I already know what's expected of that. Battlefield, yeah, sure. This is really this is really striking a chord. So I think that would be my pick.
So what do you think, Ryan?
Well, you know, my love for rhythm games. So yes, I'm probably not going to go with Taiko no Tatsujin. I'm not coordinated, so rhythm games have never been my thing. But I also think that Cereal Cleaners sounds unique. So would I be willing to try it? Sure. I mean, right now we live in an era where, you know, there are games out there where you're basically taking a power washer and washing the world. So cleaning seems to be a theme that's coming out, you know. Hopefully, right. You know, there's going to be janitorial simulator.
Toilet scrubbing simulator.
Coming out soon. But definitely Dialfield Chronicle. The magic words for me are strategy RPG and Square Enix together. So I'll be all in for that day one for sure. Blue, what about you?
Yeah, pretty much the same. Taiko no Tatsujin, I think those games are fun, like especially if you go to an arcade where they have the great big drums and you can play them and just kind of be silly. I'm not good at rhythm games either. I'm actually really, really bad at them, but they are kind of fun. And especially with, I think it was the one that came out on GameCube where it had the drums, the drum peripheral.
Oh, you're talking about Donkey Konga? Because it wasn't, maybe in Japan there was one for the GameCube.
I know
in America
sure
we didn't get it.
There's a Taiko no Tatsujin peripheral. GameCube or Switch. But
there is one for Switch for sure, yes.
Okay. See, that I think would be the best way to play it, but then you're paying for the full price game and for the peripheral.
Right.
I'm much less excited about. Cereal Cleaners, yeah, it's a weird concept. I kind of like weird indie games. I'd totally be willing to give it a chance, depending completely upon how well the stealth mechanics work. If this is a stealth game and your stealth is kind of weird or clunky or whatever, then the rest of the game completely fails. So that would be my only hesitation, where I would want to read some reviews first before I decided to jump into that one. Which kind of leaves me with the Dialfield Chronicle. I'm an okay fan of strategy RPGs. This is in that same HD 2D style that we were gushing about just a few minutes ago. So it has that going for it. And I think when we looked at the gameplay, it looked kind of like a hybrid system, not like a traditional tactical RPG, which is maybe means I would like it more. I'm not sure. But hearing G say that there's a demo, I definitely got to go check out that demo so I could know for sure.
I mean, I'm going to download that demo, actually, right after we're done.
Hell yeah. All right, let's move on to our main topic.
All right, from Screen Rant, 10 most disappointing video game cancellations. With the much-hyped Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic remake changing developers and the denial that this will lead to delays seemingly very dubious, it follows a long line of Star Wars projects that quickly ran into internal problems. Fans will be hoping that the Knights of the Old Republic will do what those games couldn't and survive its problems, but it would be fair from the biggest title to ultimately go unreleased. So let's take a look here at our 10, starting off with number 10, Project Knoxville. Danish developers Press Play went from its founding to join the Microsoft Studios family to shutting down in the space of just a decade. And that's especially tragic because it's easy to imagine how different things could have been if they were able to finish and release Project Knoxville, an Xbox One exclusive. It was to be a cooperative survival game that would let the players decide whether or not they could trust each other. An intriguing gimmick that many are still sad never came to light.
Actually, yeah, I'm quite kind of sad about this one, especially considering now, because if there's something that's really hot in kind of gaming now, beyond just survival horror games are always going to be popular. That's just all there is to it.
Right.
But the kind of 3v1 sort of aspect and games like Dead by Daylight and whatnot being so hot and so popular, why did this get canceled? Because I'm just like, this seems like that would have been a home run.
Yeah, or it might have been ahead of its time. I mean, Among Us has certainly shown that the social deduction thing is so hot right now.
Right.
But who knows if it would have been as well received when this was presumably going to come out.
Right. But I think, thinking about it in this sense, though, it was in 2016 that Press Play closed down, right? So just trying to think of what was really hot. The cooperative aspect of games wasn't really hot then yet. So I think, Blue, you might be onto something. You might be right in saying that maybe it was a little bit more ahead of its time. It's one of those things that maybe if they had just stuck by it and they tried to release it in, I don't know, like in 2020, it probably would have done a lot better. But it might have been something that may have felt a little too foreign at the time. Co-op games weren't quite as popular. It was more about PvP like around those times. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. That's kind of how it felt like at that time. But I don't know. That one's kind of sad because I feel like it would have been a success.
For sure.
All right. Number 9, World of Darkness. World of Darkness is one of the best tabletop RPGs around, so it's no surprise that fans were hotly anticipating an MMORPG set in the world of the game that would allow the player to live out the fantasy of being a vampire while keeping up the social and political elements at its heart. According to The Guardian, however, it was mismanaged almost from the very beginning, and the game was brutally canceled following the year amidst the layoffs of over 50 employees. Ouch.
I bet this is one that Donnie would have liked, since he's into the Vampire the Masquerade games.
Yeah, but translating a tabletop game to a MMORPG based off of what Cyberpunk went through, I'm always kind of skeptical.
Yeah,
that's fair. That's definitely fair.
Between Cyberpunk and stuff like Vampire the Masquerade, mm-hmm. I think ones like that, and again, going into what was really hot and popular at the time, see, cancellation in 2014. I think, weren't there a huge amount of massively multiplayer online RPGs at that time? Like, there was a flood of MMOs. Mm-hmm. So it might have just gotten lost in the shuffle anyway.
It would have been counting on that name recognition of World of Darkness.
Right,
To stand out, which may not have been enough. All right, next up at number 8, Pirates of the Caribbean, Armada of the Damned. There are some amazing pirate-themed games out there, not least the addictively fun Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag. So when fans were promised an open-world game based on the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, it's no surprise everyone started to get excited. Unfortunately, the game was in the hands of Turok developer Propaganda Games, and fans of that title are no doubt well aware of what happened. Along with a planned Turok sequel, fans were devastated when Disney Interactive Studios announced the game was dead in 2012. The release of Black Flag the following year was both a great consolation and a sad reminder of what could have been. There is no way this game would have been good. There was no way in hell this game would have been good.
Yeah. Well, this is all, yeah.
The Pirates of the Caribbean movies, the first one is great. The rest of them are flaming dumpster fires. They're all over the place. They were very clearly rushed out. And this game would have been the same, rushed out to try to capitalize on the flash in the pan popularity of this franchise, which died quickly.
Well, you know what other game they made? They also made Tron Evolution. So take that for what you will, because yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't think Disney Interactive at that point in time, they really didn't know what they were doing.
Right. Like,
they were just like, oh, okay, we'll make a game for this. And most of the games that they put out, or they would publish games that were wonderful games and give them absolutely no advertising. Split second. They're just absolutely outstanding games that give no advertising what forever. And then they would push stuff like Tron Evolution or the Turok game, which completely underwhelmed. Yeah, I can't really feel sorry for that because it probably would not have been good.
Right. Well, to say the release of Black Flag the following year was a great consolation, no, it's backwards.
No.
Assassin's Creed Black Flag.
It was a relief.
An amazing game, and it would have put anything that Pirates of the Caribbean Armada of the Damned could come up with to complete shame.
Yep.
So that was just, it was a mercy killing for this game.
Yep, I would have to agree.
And eventually you got this game anyway, because they got Sea of Thieves, which pretty much is...
Sea of Thieves is great, though.
Number 7 is Scalebound. Bayonetta 3 will likely continue Platinum Games' long success streak of amazing titles that have included Astral Chain and Nier Automata. But the Japanese developer's history hasn't always been so smooth. Scalebound was to be their ambitious collaboration with Microsoft Studios, and it looked to be a beautiful action RPG that would allow the players to command their own dragon in battle. Not only were fans severely disappointed, but Microsoft even became the subject of a lot of ire for their perceived part in the game's eventual cancellation.
This one's too low in this list, in my opinion, because this is also right around that time that Microsoft was struggling for new IPs. Like they desperately needed like new franchises, something to put, because the Xbox One was struggling. And this is like something to really put the Xbox One on the map. And this was arguably their largest high profile thing, especially since it was coming out of Japan. And then just, okay, just straight up cancel it. No, we don't want anything to do with this. I'm like, what? Why? So what did they come out with after that? Nothing. I don't know. I don't really remember what they came out with after that point. But that's all right, because Platinum Games went on to do greater things. So, yeah, I don't think they were really worried about it. They're just like, all right, whatever. We'll just do a little title called Bayonetta or Nier Automata. We'll be fine. We'll be fine.
Yeah, I think it worked out for them.
All right, number six, Project Ragtag. The Star Wars universe has become home to some incredible video games, but has also had some infamously canceled ones. One of the biggest was Project Ragtag, an action-adventure title that was to essentially be a space heist game featuring a group of scoundrels that would live up to its title. EA already suffered from a poor reputation among game fans, but their closure of Visceral Games, which ultimately resulted in Project Ragtag being canceled, only made fans more furious.
I think EA is the worst thing to ever happen to Star Wars video games.
I would have to agree. I have yet to play one Star Wars game because what they did, Battlefront 1 and 2, and then they did Jedi Fallen Order, Squadrons, and that's it, right? Or is there something else?
I think so.
Yeah, none of them wowed me. But the thing is, it's Visceral Games. You know, Visceral Games, they're the Dead Space company. They probably would have done something good with this. What, and it's like a space heist game. So what? I'm imagining it to be something like a Star Wars Payday, you know, the game series Payday, something like that.
Yeah.
That actually sounds really fun. But I guess
whatever good Visceral Games may have done, EA would just microtransaction the hell out of it and then ruin the progression system and it would be terrible.
Right.
And this one sounds to me like you'd be playing kind of like Han Solo, and I've always wanted to play as Han Solo in something. So this would be super cool as far as a concept is concerned, but I think you're right. Yeah,
you know, I had a discussion one time with some of my friends. I was just like, because we saw the Solo movie, and I was like, this would have made a much better video game than a movie.
Right.
That's a good point. Like, seriously.
Oh my gosh.
That's a great point.
I hate that movie. That movie is so bad.
They should have just taken that concept and just made it into a more expanded video game. And I think it would have been great.
And for the record, you can play as Han Solo in the Super Nintendo Star Wars games.
Oh, yes, because that's so much to the level.
That's exactly what you had in mind.
Exactly, right?
just you better be patient because you're going to die a lot.
Another game that Blue really knows how to play.
Well, I did when I was a kid. Now I try to go back and play it, and it just laughs at me.
So you're talking about like canceled Star Wars games, and what about like the Super Star Wars that was supposed to come out for the Genesis that got canceled? Who knows? Mm-hmm. Man, I missed that because we never got a Star Wars game on Genesis.
What could have been?
Yep.
All right, at number five, Maverick Hunter. Mega Man is one of Capcom's most recognizable games, but it's one that hasn't transitioned into the modern era of games as smoothly as their other titles. Maverick Hunter was to change all of that in 2010, taking the franchise in a darker, grittier direction. Anybody else want darker, grittier Mega Man?
I hate this already, but continue on.
With an all-out FPS title, Polygon reported on some of the exciting details behind the ambitious project that included a redesign for Mega Man by the artist responsible for the MCU's adaptation of Iron Man's suit. The game was ultimately canceled in the fallout of producer Keiji Inafune's departure from Capcom, as he was one of the driving forces behind the reinvention. But fans and critics still more ideas that finally made Mega Man exciting again. Oh, there's some hot takes there. The idea that fans and critics still, even to this day, mourn the idea of a dark, gritty FPS Mega Man. Go.
This is the one I was talking about, Ryan.
Yep.
Like, I'm very passionate about. And to me, it's like, okay, I'm going to give y'all three words, all right? When I read this and I remember this becoming a thing and I remember hating it back then. And the thing is, hating the concept of this back then, three words, Bomberman X-Zero. How well did that work out?
Ooh,
trying to
point.
Modernize something like Bomberman and make it darker and grittier with a first-person shooter stuff. Well, granted, that wasn't a first-person shooter. But I'm like, okay, think about this. Taking the franchise, Mega Man, in a darker, grittier direction with an all-out first-person shooter. I hate everything about this sentence.
Were they trying to Metroid Prime it?
Yeah, I think that's really what they were trying to do. I think they were trying to do something like a Metroid Prime because they saw that that worked. But the reason why Metroid Prime works so well is because it still felt like Metroid. Metroid right. always had that sort of deep and atmospheric sort of brooding feel, like a little bit of more of a scary kind of atmosphere. So it's not going against the grain. It never did. Because I understand Mega Man X, which is, you know, the whole part of the whole Maverick series. Like, well, Mega Man X is the darker Mega Man, but I would never, ever consider gritty anything to be a part of Mega Man. It's darker. It's more okay, not darker, let me rephrase that, more serious. It was right. the more serious Mega Man, which is fine, but it still had that Mega Man look and vibe that you remember from the original series. That's why X did so well. And it's like canceling the fallout of producers Keiji Inafune's departure from Capcom. Now we all know Keiji Inafune, not everything he came up with were home runs. Like, right. not everything did. I mean,
go ahead, say
Mighty
it.
Number
say
nine.
It's like Mighty Number Nine comes to mind. But to be honest, I don't hate Mighty Number Nine. Ooh. But the thing is that I actually really don't. So maybe this was one of those things that, like, they came up with this wild idea for this concept or whatnot, and Capcom is just like, yeah, we're done here. Yeah. Yeah, that's probably what might have happened in that case. But I don't know. It's like fans and critics still warn an idea that finally made Mega Man exciting again. That is just an incorrect statement, but I'm just right. saying. All right, I'm good. Told you I had a lot to say about that. Like, nope.
All right, next up, number four, Half-Life 2, Episode 3. I just heard David, Wizard of Zardoz's heart just break right now.
I'll just send the chat.
Yep. If there's one canceled game that everyone wished they could play, it's probably Half-Life 3, which has become an internet legend at this point. Whilst many canceled games get people's hopes up, only to disappoint them even worse. For Half-Life fans, and Half-Life 2 Episode 2 ended on such a massive cliffhanger. Level designer Dario Casale attributed the lack of Episode 3 to a variety of factors, including the simple fact that they couldn't seem to come up with creative spark needed for a worthy successor to their critically acclaimed classic. I gotta say that that's maybe a good thing. If you can't come up with something good,
true,
don't make it.
If you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. If you can't come up with a yeah. good ending, just don't end it.
Yep. And the thing is, I know a lot of people give Nintendo flack for not making a new F-Zero. They've said several times, we just don't have anything new for the franchise. And if they can't think of anything new, they're not going to force it. Like, no, right. don't force it, because I'd rather them end on the extremely high note that they did. Same thing with Half-Life. It's like they end up with like the extremely high note that they did rather than go out with a bang and not a whimper. Basically is what that is. And they don't want that to go out with a whimper if they don't want to force it if they don't have any new ideas. So I respect that.
Right.
Sure. Better to be remembered fondly than not.
Die the hero instead of live long enough to become the villain. And while you feel sad for the fans that they didn't get to see the story wrapped up because episode two ended on a massive cliffhanger, at least the lack of an ending, what that allows the fans to do is go out and do the fan fiction, go out mm-hmm. and take the world that they love and write endings that they enjoy, as opposed to being stuck with something that may suck and yet would be canon.
Right.
Episode three ends up being a rhythm game.
Yeah.
It's next one's a mobile game, because that's how it's going to go. All right. So number three, Chrono Break. This is going to hurt. Chrono Trigger and Chrono Cross are considered two masterpieces from a golden era of JRPGs. So it's no surprise fans would have given anything to get their hands on the planned follow-up title in the series. According to IGN, Square registered the trademark for the title Chrono Break all the way back in 2001. Ever since then, fans have speculated wildly about what could have been the third mainline title in the series, despite the fact that Square themselves hardly revealed any details. As a result, there was always a high chance fans would ultimately be disappointed, and with the trademark expiring as of 2021, that sadly seems to be the case.
Brian, are you okay?
I'm going to need a minute.
So this is like you with me and Maverick Hunter. You're gonna need that time to talk.
Right. And I absolutely love Chrono Trigger. I think it's the best game, in my opinion. That's, again, my opinion. And the wealth of story that was in it, and the characters and everything that just makes that game so incredibly unique and special. there's, again, part of me that maybe is glad that it wasn't a third game wasn't created for the series, in the sense that it could take away some of that mystique. But with Chrono Trigger, I've been dying for another another iteration of it, but I want it to be just as good as the original. So
that's a tough act to follow.
Yeah, big shoes to fill. Well, can I be real with y'all? I've never actually played Chrono Trigger.
Ooh.
So
my heart breaks.
you forget I was a Sega kid. I couldn't even tell you like what the reason is. I've just somehow missed it. And I've had access to it, but I've just somehow missed it throughout the years. But I have played Chrono Cross though. So Chrono Cross I did play, but I did not play Chrono Trigger. And once again, looking at this, it's just that maybe they had something in the works, but they just really couldn't conjure something together. And then they just kind of let it silently expire rather than to get people's hopes up and realize, okay, they don't really have anything there. Again, this is going back to Half-Life. It's like, right, if you don't really have anything there, don't push it. As somebody who is a little scared right now, because my personal favorite Square RPG series is coming out with a new game that's radically different, and I'm a little scared. Valkyrie Elysium. It's like, I'm a little afraid. Yeah. Because I love Valkyrie Profile. It's my favorite RPG ever. And
I like, love this that game
different.
Too.
I'm like, I don't know. There's a demo. I haven't gotten a chance to try it yet.
And I was going to say, the trademark expired in 2021, which is a little bit weird because Square Enix has been coming out with so many new RPGs lately. The last several years. We talked about the Dialfield Chronicle in the top three new releases, but they've also got Octopath Traveler and they've got Harvestella just came out. Let's see, Neo, the World Ends With You and Live Alive got a port. We're going to get a new Final Fantasy soon. So it's not like they've run out of ideas for RPGs. So it does kind of make you wonder what happened with this one that they just decided it wasn't worth pursuing.
I wonder if it's because the fan expectations would be so high for this.
That's what I was going to say. The expectations. I think maybe they just didn't want to disappoint because they realized that they could come out. Honestly, if they came out with a new Final Fantasy and it wound up being a disappointment, I think people would move on. If they came out with a new Chrono Trigger and it turned out to be a disappointment, they would never hear the end of it.
I kind of see where you're going, but I also think Square Enix doesn't give a rat's butt whether they disappoint their people.
That's true.
Your friends, we all remember the Chrono Trigger mobile port that was released on Steam. And we all know how in love Square Enix is right now with NFTs and such. Did you want to go buy that cloud figurine? Well, you get NFTs with it if you want the figurine. So Square Enix is completely out of touch, I believe, with what their fans actually want.
I would totally buy an NFT to get a Chrono Trigger figure.
Wow.
I've sold out.
I'm just staring at Square and Ball in Wonderworld. That's what I'm looking at you in. Right.
All right. Coming in at number two, Silent Hills. This is the one that makes me...
I knew it.
Yep.
It's hard to think of a more high-profile game cancellation than that of Silent Hills. What makes it a particularly sore spot for Silent Hill fans is not just that it had the likes of Hideo Kojima and Guillermo del Toro involved, but also that it was far enough in development to produce a full demo. That demo, titled PT, caused an internet storm in its own right, and fans would have given anything to see the full game, can confirm. However, Polygon reported that a cancellation seemed imminent in 2015 in the wake of Kojima and Konami parting ways, and it wasn't long before the cancellation was confirmed to the sadness of fans everywhere. This game would have been amazing, I can guarantee it, and it was the victim of Kojima and Konami getting divorced and selling off the assets and just ruining everything.
Yep.
The kids are always the victim in that situation.
We were the victims in this breakup. We were the actual victims.
For the longest time, I had that PT demo sitting on one before my PS4 died. Like it was sitting on my PS4 for the longest time. Now, granted, I have a PS5 now, so I can't transfer it over to that. So it's sitting in a PS4 backup on my hard drive right now. And I'm just like, man, this could have really, really been something.
Yeah.
However, I still think in some capacity, it might not be Silent Hills, it might not be PT, whoever Kojima decides to go along with at some point in time, I think we're going to see this get reimagined in some way.
I mean, I hope so. Death Stranding really shook my faith in Kojima, I'm not going to lie.
I still haven't played it, so I can't comment on it.
Yeah, don't recommend. But I think what also makes this kind of a giant middle finger to the fans is that Konami has done jack shit with Silent Hill franchise since then. They even went so far as to let the domain name expire so some fan could snap it up. They really care that little. You don't deserve Silent Hill. You don't deserve to be caretakers of this IP when you had something so great and you just decided to burn it all because you were mad at Kojima.
Right. It's a legacy franchise. I mean, whether or not, I mean, take a look at what they did with Contra, right? It's just like, okay, you still have legacy franchises that you could do amazing things with or without. I mean, even if you don't have Kojima. But I, as I say that, I'm like, oh, wait a minute, Miller, you're so hype. Never mind.
Right.
All right. And number one, Star Wars 1313. There's only one canceled Star Wars title that left fans more disappointed than Project Ragtag, and that's Star Wars 1313. Developed by LucasArts, the game was set to be in an open world environment and would focus on bounty hunters. These two things immediately hooked fans who liked the idea of a renegade in a gritty, fleshed-out Star Wars environment. Along with a demo that featured Boba Fett, everything was looking extremely promising until Disney's buyout led to the closure of LucasArts. Escapist Magazine reported the trademark had officially been abandoned in 2014, leading to the despair for fans who still held out hope that the title may one day see the light of day.
This title was sacrificed to Disney's cleansing of the old expanded universe and them deciding to burn everything that came before and we're going to start over fresh and it's all going to be ours.
Jeez.
That's exactly what happened.
This upsets me too because, I'm not a gigantic Star Wars fan as far as like, you know, the movies and the TV shows and whatnot. I'm generally not, but I love the Star Wars video games. Like, you give me a really good Star Wars video game, and I'm all about it. And we talked earlier about why I've been disappointed with EA's handling in the franchise. Mm-hmm. And that's just another case right there that they're like, okay, well, then we're just shutting this down. We're starting everything anew, and we're going to have our own Star Wars cinematic universe. And we're just going to leave you behind. Because that's how Disney works, right? They work a cinematic universe.
We're going to have our own Star Wars universe with blackjack and hookers.
Yep. And I mean, forget the Star Wars universe and the blackjack, right?
Right.
But yeah, it's frustrating because why would you throw away all of that work?
Because it wasn't theirs. Because Disney knows best. Disney says, oh, we'll just whip up a whole new universe, new backstories for everybody, officially retcon everything. And sad. That's just Disney's arrogance with no respect for the property that they'd actually bought.
Right, exactly.
Soapbox done.
I think this is bleeding into the movies for you, Blue.
I said soapbox done.
It's like, I have spoken.
I have spoken and I shall say no more. Before everybody turns this off. All right, before we move on, let's take a quick break to talk about our sponsor. This segment is proudly sponsored by the Elitist Podcast. It's a show where three friends and occasional guests play games about video games, including trivia, game show games, and more. Here is this week's trivia question. In 1994, a British postdoctoral fellow detected a gene and protein that separates your right brain from the left and determines you have two eyes. He named the gene after a comic based on a video game his six-year-old was reading, inspired by the fact that the protagonist's hairstyle looked vaguely similar to the gene. Name the comic. Tune into the Elitist Podcast this Wednesday to hear the answer. You can find the Elitist on your favorite podcast platform, and we'll also have their links in the show notes. I couldn't even begin to guess.
The genes and protein that separates your right brain from your left brain that determines you have two eyes is called
redacted.
Right. Oh, I remember that.
All right. Weird. I would not have guessed that in a million years, but there we are.
Thank you for coming, students. Please take your seats. Welcome back to Professor Rybrand's Gaming History 101. And in today's lesson, we're going to talk about the first Sega console to ever hit the North American market. No, not the Sega Genesis, but the Sega Master System Power Base. And G, thank you for the inspiration for today's Professor Rybrand.
I'm sitting down and I'm eager to listen, Professor.
Excellent.
As much as I love talking Master System. So do go.
Excellent. So out of curiosity, did you have a Master System when you were a kid?
Not when I was a kid. I actually didn't get my own Master System until roughly about college. Although I had cousins that lived in another state that we went to go visit. Funny thing is that we went to go visit them, and I had never seen a Master System. I knew about the Genesis, but I had never seen a Master System, and they had a Double Dragon. Which, if, for those who don't know, Double Dragon on the Master System is different from the NES version. It's actually a lot more faithful to the arcade, and it has two-player. So that kind of blew my mind as somebody who played it in the arcade and then played the NES one, knew that it was different, then saw the Master System one, and I was like, whoa, this is this is a change. And yeah, no, it's such a fascinating system. And yeah, it's such a shame that it didn't do as well as it did in the US. But then, you know, when it comes to gaming history, everything kind of happens for a reason, right?
For sure. For
sure. So if the Master System didn't do as well as it did in North America, or if it did better, let's say if it did better in North America and it had a longer extended life, what would the Genesis have been like? Would we have gotten Sonic the Hedgehog? What would have happened?
Yeah, you know? Would have been Alex the Kid, or Alex Kid, not Alex the Kid.
Common mistake.
Yeah, I caught myself. All right, so let's start things from the beginning. So Sega is a company that has been around since the 1940s and was originally called Standard Games, which was a coin-operated gambling machine manufacturer. After World War II, they changed the name to Service Games, as their target market was service members stationed in Hawaii at Pearl Harbor. The company sought to gain a foothold in the recently occupied Japanese market and eventually opened up a division called Service Games of Japan. In 1951, however, legislation was passed in the U.S. that outlawed gambling machines, which turned the business's entire focus to the Japanese market, eventually changing their name to a portmanteau of Service Games, which, of course, is extremely popular in Japan, to Sega.
Sega. Or in some countries, Sega.
Indeed. In fact, Sega and Sega is also the... Where I grew up, it was Sega, not Sega.
Right. But also acceptable.
Yeah. So as time went on, Sega... began to focus on arcade-style coin-operated games, and by the 1980s rolled around, they were essentially a well-known arcade manufacturer. With the burgeoning success of home console market, Sega decided to throw their hat into the ring by creating their own cartridge-based system known as the SG-1000 for Japan, which for all intents and purposes was essentially a beefed-up ColecoVision system. Now, releasing on July 15th of 1983, the exact same day and at the same price as the Nintendo Famicom. So the SG-1000 was technically inferior to the Famicom technology-wise and likely resulted in poor sales compared to the Nintendo, even though they released other models like the SG-3000 with a fully functional keyboard and the SG-1002. Sega still struggled to overcome the dominating sales of the Famicom. So in 1985, Sega decided to pour a bunch of upgraded technology into the new system to truly compete with the Famicom, and the Sega Mark III was born. It was graphically superior to the Famicom, contained more colors, and had a better sound chip. But there was a problem that Sega didn't anticipate. Regardless of the fact that the system was more advanced, Nintendo's ownership over the console's gaming market wasn't just limited to sales, as their contract agreements with developers included exclusivity rights that prevented them from making games for other consoles. The only two third-party companies at the time of the release for Sega was Activision and Parker Brothers. That means Sega had to create their own first-party titles to compete. So eventually, in September of 1986, Sega decided to release a version of the Mark III in North American market, redesigning the system to look more sleek and appealing to North American audiences and renaming it the Sega Master System. The idea being, just like in martial arts, there can only be one true master. Now, despite a strong marketing campaign for the system, Nintendo's foothold over the North American marketplace made sales difficult. Frustrated with the lack of success in both markets, Sega looked for another market that wasn't dominated by Nintendo. Europe at the time was focused on PC gamings with the systems like the ZX Spectrum that could be purchased for much less than the NES, and games were considerably cheaper, some selling for as low as 99 pence in the UK, with the NES games selling for £50. It was just very unattractive in that aspect, and Sega kind of saw blood in the water, more or less, for the Master System by pricing it much less than the NES and selling games for almost half the price. Now, the marketing focuses on the idea that there was zero load times with the Master System, which was appealing to European gamers considering most of the games were played using cassette tapes, which could take minutes to load up. Now, the Master System blew up in the European market as well, because several European-based developers began to program for the system. This meant a whole heap of European exclusives, leading to the library of 260-plus games compared to 114 available in North America. Now, looking to expand on this idea of untapped markets, Sega started to market the games into the up-and-coming Brazilian and Australian markets. Similar to Europe, Australia was focused on PC games at the time, and the same marketing plan used in Europe was deployed for Australia with similar success. In Brazil, however, Sega was approached by an electronic toy company, Tectoy, which wanted to sell the system. And hesitant at first, Sega eventually released as the Sega Master System 2 in Brazil in 1989. Which means when the Sega Master System 2 that were released everywhere else, which was a miniature version of the Master System, similar to, you know, like Nintendo's top loader, they actually had to call it the Master System 3 Compact in Brazil. Now, the system was widely popular, leading to 80% market share in Brazil, and the system was so well received that Tectoy was creating different versions of the Master System up until 2003. Selling 6 million units before the end of the 1990s, only second to Europe's 7 million units sold. Some of the other versions that were sold were was a Sega Master System Girl with a pink and purple aesthetic. Yep.
I hate it. Thanks.
I know. I knew you were going to hate it. And the Master System Super Compact that used wireless RF output, which I kind of hate because I know how terrible that works. Now, there were also a fair number of region-exclusive titles released in Brazil up until 1998, including Mortal Kombat 3, Street Fighter 2, and Earthworm Jim on this 8-bit system. Now, currently, Tectoy is selling the Master System Evolution, a plug-and-play system that includes over 130 games. Crazy as it sounds, since 2000, 2 million Master System units have been sold in Brazil alone. So to kind of wrap things up with the Sega Master System, it was a fantastic console that can be considered a role model for persistence. And in recent years, it's been a sought-after system for game collectors, especially in North America, who want to experience a system that rivals the power of the NES and includes new games that they may have missed. Now, if you want to get your hands on these games but don't want to buy a whole new console, may I recommend buying a power base converter that allows you to play those games by plugging it into the top of your Sega Genesis or Mega Drive.
Bravo. Bravo. Yeah. Sorry, I was just sitting and listening. I was just like, I'm just listening. Go on. So yeah, the Master System it's such a fascinating console. Not just like what came out in Brazil and Tectoy, but just the amount of games that came out over in Europe that we did not get over here. Right. It's like the only Sonic game. I'm just going to start off with Sonic. It's like the only Sonic game that came out in North America was the original. Meanwhile, in Europe, they got Sonic 2, a version of the Game Gear version of Sonic 2. They got Sonic Chaos. They got Sonic Spinball. And then they also got a version of Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine. And in Brazil, they got Sonic Blast, which is not great, but at least they still got it. You know, they still got all of these games. No Triple Trouble, but they at least got all of those. And then, I own a handful of the Tectoy Brazilian exclusives.
Nice.
I have Battletoads and Battlemaniacs. I have Virtua Fighter Animation. And I have Street Fighter 2. And the Street Fighters, we were talking earlier about Turtles Tournament Fighters, right? Mm-hmm. And that's an example of how to do it on an 8-bit system. Street Fighter 2 on Master System, not so much. It doesn't play well at all. It looks great. Like, it's a beautiful game. Like, you could really, like, it's really close to being 16-bit quality as far as it looks. And it has some of the clearest announcer voices out of anything you'll hear on a Master System. But the game doesn't play well. Mortal Kombat 3 is broken. Like, it's a totally, totally broken game. But then there's also the other oddities that are out there. Like, there's a Dynamite Heady from the Master System that's exclusive to Brazil. There's a Legend of Illusion that's exclusive to it in Brazil. Like, it's nuts how all these and then over in the European side, there's a version of Aladdin that's based off the Game Gear. That's a wonderful. No, hardly anybody has played this Aladdin game, and it's awesome. And so many other Game Gear conversions to fit the screen that we didn't get here in North America. And it's just such a shame. And you were talking about the publishers that were really there to support Master System. It's like, well, yeah, because Nintendo had such a stronghold on third-party companies back in those days that they legally could not do stuff for the Master System.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, Nintendo would just basically cut the legs off. I mean, not literally, but I mean,
you never know. It's Nintendo.
But I think for what it's worth, I think Sega did a really good try with it, but we all know they didn't really hit their stride until the Genesis. But I always say to everybody, if you have any interest or any curiosity, whatever means that you have to play some Master System games, check them out. You won't regret it.
Definitely. So thank you for attending today's lesson. Big thank you to Nostalgia Nerd on YouTube for some of today's information covered today. And just a reminder, if you have any ideas for a story you'd like to hear, email us at gamersweekpodcast@gmail.com and we might feature your suggestion.
All right, let's go ahead and wrap up the show. Thank you for listening to episode 40 of Gamers Week Podcast. And a big thank you to the Retro Game Club Podcast, the Elitist Podcast, and Love Retro BTW for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check out their links in the show notes. If you want to connect with Gamers Week, follow us on Twitter at Gamers Week PC, email us at gamersweekpodcast@gmail.com, visit our merch store at gamers-week-podcast.creator-spring.com, or if you want to do it the easy way, follow the link in the show notes. Join us on Patreon at patreon.com/gamersweek. Finally, since you made it all the way to the end of this episode, please leave us a rating and a review to let us know how we did. We really do value your feedback. And while you're there, consider subscribing on iTunes, Spotify, or your podcast platform of choice. And also don't forget, we will have G's links in the show notes, so be sure to check him out. G, thank you so much for filling in for us tonight. This was amazing.
Hey, and once again, thank you for having me. It was awesome.
Yeah, G, thank you so much, man. Really, really appreciate your insight and some of your jokes here. So thank you again.
Appreciate it.
All right. That's it for us tonight. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
Good night.
Nothing.
Welcome to Gamers Week Uncut.
Welcome to Gamers Week Uncut.
Welcome to Gamers Week Uncut, patrons with benefits. This is the unscripted, patron-only bonus cast with less editing and more dirty jokes. We don't know where the conversation will go, but we're sure it will be weird.
This fish just went right on my nipple, and I'm just like...
I Google Street Fighter 6. The first search result that comes up is people think they can see Ryu's dick in the Street Fighter 6 reveal.
Listen up here, kids. You're not going to want to get one of those VDSTDs things, right? Make your dick fall off. When you go, grab a pro. You'll be doing it for America.
That was perfect.
If you want to hear weekly episodes of our patron-only bonus cast, join us at patreon.com/gamersweek.